Welcome to Forging Links. Forging Links is the voice of European social democratic activists with an Anglo-Dutch flavor. The podcast is an initiative of A-Union and the platform aiming to empower political activists by developing their skill sets, sharing their stories, and generating social, environmental, economic impact. We're trying to promote the idea of politics with love, solidarity, and prosperity. If you want to know more about A-Union, you can visit our website. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank Dunn Street and the people from Socially Democratic Podcast who have helped us behind the scene, our producer, Mike, and most importantly, you for listening. So enjoy. Thank you very much. So we're here today on Forging Links. We're speaking with Lefteris, who has a breadth and wealth of background in political activism on a European level, on a councillor level within Athens. You live at the moment in Greece. You've been working in Greece for a while. You were actually born in France, I believe, and you also studied at university there. So a really European identity, let's just say. And right now you are really deep working in the whole area of refugee and migration issues within Greece. And of course, the impact of that is on a whole European level. I mean, please tell us about yourself and especially your name, which I will struggle to pronounce.
Yes, thanks for having me, first of all. My name is Lefteris Papagiannakis. I'm the director of the Greek Council for Refugees. I have done a lot of things, during my career, my professional career. I was working with a Muslim minority in the north of Greece on education, and then I worked as a legal counselor in the political party College of Greens. I worked with the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change and in the Directorate of Environmental Inspection. I've done a number of things. And politically speaking, I was elected in the Municipal Council of Athens in 2014, and I was named Vice Mayor for Migrant and Refugee Affairs by the Mayor of Athens in 2016. It's right in the middle of what we called, I disagree with the term, but that's another point, with the refugee crisis. So I was responsible on the response of Athens during this, I would say, very challenging period of time.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And I believe you had you started your career after studying in France in the European Parliament.
That was my first job, basically. I went directly from France, from Lille, where I studied, to Brussels in order to work in the Parliament. It fitted because I did European studies back then, the European Economic Community, as it was called back then. It was because it's a while, it's not the Union. And I wasn't, I was working in the office of a member of Parliament, who happened to be my father back then. It was allowed, now it's not allowed anymore, which is good, I would say, because also this possibility was brutally taken advantage of from some of the members of the Parliament, and the regulation changed. But I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And I spent 3 years, 2.5 actually, in the Parliament, and I also did an internship in the Commission for 6 months. The internship that I think most people that are dealing with European affairs have gone through, because it's almost mandatory, I would say, to go through this.
It's like a rite of passage. Because,
yeah, it's the first contact that you have with the Commission and the work that European institutions work. So it was extremely interesting to know a bit of both sides,
I would say. That's an interesting point. I met you in Athens. I was on a visit. We were talking to a whole bunch of lecturers and politicians and NGOs, and I spoke also to the Dutch ambassador to Athens. Most of them were kind of like, oh yeah, Greece is doing okay, we're trotting along, things are getting better, because they were really bad during the, not just the refugee crisis, but before that, the financial crisis or the euro crisis that occurred. it you know, there had been such a low point that things could only get better, let's just say. And from a leftist point of view, it's almost always been like that. When things are at their worst, the left, right, you know, stands up for people in solidarity and brings them together. Now, Greece, the opposite occurred. It kind of yo-yoed between left and right, and then now you have a center-right, or you could just say a right, in power. You come from an ecological side, but your background, I believe your father was on the left. And so navigating all of that for you, did you fall into the whole refugee aspect of things? Or was it something that you actually had been building towards, and when the opportunity came in Athens, you took it up?
No, maybe it's not the right way to present it, but it was also it was more of an opportunity or accidental thing, if I may call it like this. When the mayor gives positions to his vice mayors or his councillors, etc., he chooses an area of interest for them. So he decides on what the areas of policy are, and then he names them. After the first vice mayors, then you have executive councillors. Okay, you have a number of choices. At the end of this process, because I was a newbie, so I couldn't expect to get a position immediately, there were two sectors that were left to distribute if you want. One of them was climate and the way that Athens could face or what, you know, the interventions of Athens in the context of the climate change crisis. And the other was migration, meaning back then it was the Council for Migrant Integration, which is a council that exists at least in Athens, but in other cities also. So there is a president named by the mayor. So these two areas were available. And there was a discussion on it, and it was me and a colleague that were waiting to be, you know, to be named in an area of interest. So my colleague, Lenio Merivili, got the climate crisis portfolio and climate change because she's also been working in academia on this field. And I was named the president of the Migrant Integration Council. I was involved and interested because of my interest in human rights. So it was not specifically migrants and refugees. It was a more broad context of human rights issues. Of course, when you deal with migrants and refugees in the context of Athens in 2015, you immediately gain experience because in 2015, what we call the refugee crisis started, exploded basically. So very quickly, I was involved in basically managing the response of Athens in the context of the crisis, if you want. So we created a whole new set of interventions and initiatives from the side of the city, but also expand them with collaboration with other Greek cities, but also other European cities, etc. So it went on from there. It was not something that was in my mind to do. Of course, from the point of view of human rights, it is part of that, but it became more specific because of the need and the reality that Athens faced. I was raised in a very political house. I mean, my mother was a lawyer dealing with very sensitive cases of gender-based violence. She is a feminist, a first-generation feminist. My father was in the end, a politician, but he was always a political activist. They were both, raised in the May 68 context. I mean, they were in Paris in May 68. They were participating in the riots back then. There were members of the Greek community of students reacting and participating in these events. So, you know.
Can you tell us a little bit, like a summary of the events in Paris?
I mean, it was the uprising of students. In May 68, and the motto was, if not now, then when? If not us, then who? And, all the events that led to violence, a lot of violence back then. The French government brought the army in the streets, etc. It was a student uprising, It was linked to the anti-war movement, the anti-nuclear movement, pacifist movement, etc. All around Europe, you had this event, but mm-hmm. May 68 is the most symbolic uprising. Then you had the spillover of terrorism, left terrorism in Germany, in Italy, etc. So we know all of it. But Paris is the symbol of all of this uprising, especially from students. We saw that in a different context in Greece in 1974 with the Polytechnical School, the law school, where students opposed the dictatorship. And because of the uprising of 74, the dictatorship in Greece fell, so et cetera, et cetera. So it's my parents also were stuck in France because of the dictatorship. They couldn't get back to France, especially my father, because he was on a blacklist. So they couldn't return to Greece. That's why I was born in France, because I wouldn't call it, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but you can say in a political context that they were somehow, in a sense, they were not persecuted per se, but they were political refugees, in a sense, in a very broad sense. Yeah. I don't like to use it as an argument because it's not very convincing, but many people who were studying abroad, especially in Europe, they couldn't come back to Greece during the dictatorship, although they wanted to come back mm-hmm. to fight the dictatorship, but they were on a blacklist and they would be arrested if they would set foot. My parents tried to come back at some point, but the captain of the boat connecting Italy to Greece said to my father, if you disembark, then you will be arrested. So please don't do it. And he went back. Mm-hmm. My mother set foot and he went back. So I would say that, injustice and how do you react to that, and intolerance and xenophobia and racism and, political persecution and regimes that put down people and illiberal regimes, illiberal democracy, etc. It's something that comes from growing up. I was dipped into this. Into this portion of politics since a very young age. Political discussions were taking place in our house daily, I would say, especially in France, because people were very interested on what was happening in Greece. They wanted to do something. They knew that it was difficult. And I found out also that my father had a very thick file in the secret services Greece was going through a dictatorship, a military junta. And we know that it came from the Americans because they apologized to Greece for the dictatorship. They had something to do with it. They thought that the communist danger was under Portas, and they basically led Greece into the dictatorship, like all South American countries. So we are part of this universe, if you want. And we cannot forget it, because friends of my parents got tortured in prisons. They stayed in prisons for a long period of time. Pre-dictatorship period, my parents were persecuted by authorities. Friends of my parents were also beaten up by enemies, by right-wing extremists or paramilitary or parastate actors. So we grew up in this. So reacting to any kind of approach that could lead to this again, it's something that comes, I would say, naturally, but it is an instinctive reaction, I would say.
Do you see a problem with being able to advocate for ecological and environmental issues in terms of resource allocation when you have these other major crises, financial, refugee, occurring almost on a yo-yo basis in Greece? It's either a refugee crisis, and then suddenly that slows down, and then you've got another mini financial crisis or a scandal, and then it yo-yos back to it's never able to break through.
Yeah, you can use the war in Ukraine also that created the energy crisis that also led to another financial crisis, etc. So it's vicious circles connected to each other, so it never stops. At least for the last 15 years, Greece has been through crisis mode, is in crisis mode. Constantly, I would say. And when it is not a crisis mode, usually the governments use the crisis mode argument in order to avoid accountability, planning, investments, etc. So you say, I am in crisis, and you feel that you are out of, you know, you don't need to be controlled. We are asking constantly for money to change things, but without presenting a plan, etc. So it can be part of a political game also, if you want. And that's why I'm part of why I'm critical towards what the government is doing and what the crisis approach leads to. As far as ecological or green policies and politics have to do, you know, concerning Greece, I would say that Greece has lost a lot of opportunities to adapt to what is was coming, always with very bad excuses, but always because behind the political choices, you had interests, financial interests, very strong financial interests that were not ready to adapt. Now that these financial interests are ready to adapt, you see a very strong investment in, you know, renewable energies, etc. 20 years ago, they were not ready and they didn't let things progress. Now that they're ready to adapt, now they play game and they want to play it on their own, only them. So then they block any type of policy that includes citizens or associations of persons that could, for example, produce energy on their own without going through a major company. So it is, Greece is run by basically by financial interests and huge interest in general, because Greece is a very interesting geopolitical player because of.
And then you see also China playing a very key role, of course, in this building quality at a fast rate. China's strategy is we do it ourselves. So they bring their people, they do the planning, they do the implementing, they do the construction. So it's almost like the money, they pay the money to themselves. But the side effect is you have a port that works. And guess what? It works for Chinese products coming in and out. So it's not really, it's almost like they are the equivalent of chartered cities. So those two, do they play a role, a key role in this whole discussion as a solution side that people say, why don't you get these guys in?
We have our own. And our own are quite strong because they do a lot of projects in the Middle East. So we have a lot of companies present in Dubai, in Abu Dhabi, in you know, the Emirates, etc. So we have that type of connection and we know how it works. But the Chinese, where it came into Greece, meaning they came into Europe because of the financial crisis. As you know, the biggest port in Greece belongs to Costco. So Costco came in and helped out, if you want, buying the port of Piraeus. And there were a lot of reactions back then from partners, member states in the EU, saying, what are you doing? I mean, this is crazy. You're giving them a foot into Europe. And, you know, there was a big geopolitical discussion in the context of the EU. We know that it's not a very interesting issue for society, and they don't understand these big issues because no one takes the time to explain to them why it is an issue. Because, you know, money comes in and that's enough. It was kind of the approach that we used. We are in a crisis. We have memorandum rules. We need to find income. They offer it. Let's take it. Very simple. And then that led. Now the Americans are investing in the port of Alexandroupolis in the north of Greece, and that causes a lot of issues with Turkey because Turkey reacts to Alexandroupolis.
But that's for military mainly for military purposes.
Yeah, but if you have thousands of military personnel in a city, it means that the city grows locally and the local economy, etc., etc. So Alexandroupolis, being a city that is far from Athens, because Greece is a very centralized state, it is important to have even this type of development, economic development. So, and then the same almost happened with the port of Thessaloniki, but finally the Chinese didn't buy it. There were Russian and French interests that are involved in the port of Thessaloniki exactly for these reasons. France wanted to be involved in order to stop the expansion of China. So it's complex issues that you need to make to explain simple in a simple way to people so they can understand the challenges that surround these issues. But it takes a lot of time and you have to do it in a simple way. And many times people don't have the time to do it. And the governments do not care to explain. So you have a political debate on a panel. No one understands basically what happened. So they don't care. Money comes in, that's enough. Or you know, they follow the counter argument, it is dangerous for our country, etc. But also, we could explain, for example, that we have some type of neocolonialism through China getting position in the Sahel, in Africa, etc. And they're doing it in a much worse way because they bring their own stuff, etc., as you mentioned. So these are complex issues, but history has a tendency to repeat itself as a joke or as a tragedy. So let's see. I mean, something will happen. We don't know exactly what.
What's the role of nationalists in this case? Because from what I've understood or read, nationalists don't seem to be in such an uproar about it. It doesn't come across as a matter of national pride to have all these investments. It's almost the opposite. Like, look how wonderful we are. We're getting these investments. We should be proud of ourselves, which is ironic because pride, nationalists should stem from a national rebuilding programs and a national identity. How does that play out?
Yeah, nationalists in Greece use only the identity side of things. They get that Greece is very fragile from the economic front, and we need money to have a nation, and we need money to do to use nationalistic arguments. So they insist very much on the identity side of it. Now the big debate is demographics. Greece is disappearing, so we have to give birth to Greek babies. We don't need migrants, or else, you know, the purity of the race will be. And they use this type of argument. So a very racial and nationalistic and racist. Our identity is important. The rest we will figure it out. If people want to give us money because we are Greeks, it's fine. Okay, we won't sell out everything, but some things, okay, let's do it. Also, don't forget that Greeks have a very high rate of approval of Russia, of acceptance of Russia in general, because Russians are blonde, are Christian Orthodox, and they're pretty much like us. So they are virile, they're macho. We can connect, we can relate to them. So in Europe, we have the highest rate of acceptance of Russia and Putin, etc. And these things mingle, and they're intertwined, and it's a very complicated outcome. What you get is very complicated, and it's very mixed, and sometimes it's very confusing, to be honest. So yes, we are Europeans, but yes, we are also supporting Russia because they are a religious brothers and the arch between Greece, Serbia, and Russia. Okay, Russia are in good terms with China, so it's okay. So it's a very complicated and very, how can I say it? It's a very confusing mix, depending on the period. But basically, nationalists use the identity side of the argument.
It's very difficult for Northern or Western Europeans, basically the Benelux, Germans, French, to fully comprehend the situation in Greece and the vulnerability of democracy in Greece in general. Reckons that the center-right, New Democracy, is the best option. I think their leader is almost like the poster child for the Christian Democrats or the Christian right. He is like all the conservatives generally. They seem to just put a lot of pressure there, a lot of support towards him and his government and the New Democratic Movement, how democratic it is. But regardless, that added value of interest and support towards the conservatives, how detrimental has it been towards the Greens and the socialists to be able to advocate for alternative policies?
Basically, socialists were blown away because of the crisis, because it was the socialist prime minister who brought Greece into the hands of the IMF. Yiannis Papandreou, back then in 2010, announced that Greece has to go into a memorandum because, or else we're done. I mean, or else we are going to declare bankruptcy. So they paid that price. And they paid that price also because...
This was PASOK or...
PASOK.
PASOK, yep. PASOK has never recovered since then, a movement. Never recovered.
They are a bit better than in the... You know, they're in a bit better shape than in the last, I would say, 6 to 7 years, but they have never recovered. still, because they were replaced by Syriza, by this the left movement, so who took their place. So they never recovered from that. The Greens never managed to create a strong movement because they were always participating in another movement, or for me at least, the Green movement in Greece started by a very leftist origin and never decided on how to participate in political life. Do we have a more German approach, if I may call it like this, you know, a more realistic Green and governmental, if you want, at some point approach, or we are going to continue to be a more activistic Green movement that hopes at some point to convince everyone that this is the important issue and we need to go in this direction. They never managed to decide, and they never managed to break. And they never broke their glass ceiling. They broke their glass ceiling by participating in the Syriza government back in 2015. But the choices that the Syriza government made, some of them were completely opposite to the values of the Green movement. And it took a toll also on the Green. And they have never recovered from that either. So we have many smaller Green groups trying to take over the Green legacy, but it's ineffective because it's always the same people coming back, declaring their interest to participate, etc. But if you see the same faces, there is nothing new. And the same faces also are an issue in the Green movement. In my opinion, you know, it doesn't concern me and it has to do with people I know. But unfortunately, if you use the same people over and over again, saying different things, it cannot be convincing. And the socialists, at some point also, they, in order to recover, they change, as it happened all around Europe, you know that better than me, they turn a bit to the right or more, depending on the issues. In migration, for example, they turn very right. Social justice, sometimes they gave up on the principles in order to fit in the more conservative audience and trying to recuperate a bit of their electorate. So we see it all around Europe. Macron is the best example. Macron destroyed the left, the socialists in France, and then he destroyed the right. And now there's nothing left. And apparently, in the next election, Marine Le Pen will be elected.
You talked about growing up in a very political household. Did you have alternative dreams to that? Or was that just so dominant that it's even difficult for you now to like break away from it?
No. It was helpful in order to find a way, if you want. The first act of rebellion towards my parents, for example, it was that I didn't study economics like my father, and I studied law like my mother, but I didn't become a lawyer. So navigating through their, you know, what they wanted, you know, all kids growing up, at least the ones that are fortunate enough to have the possibility to study and go to the university. Because my parents were the first ones in their families to go to university. It was from the point of view of social mobility, they were the first generation moving up, if you want, to the ladder. So for me, it was an easy pathway. And I had the choice to study in Greece or abroad. So I studied in France because we had the possibility for me to study abroad and invest the money needed. So I was lucky. I didn't get into politics until very, very late. My father passed away and then I got involved in politics. In Greece, it's a very classic pathway for the children to immediately follow the political footsteps of their parents and inherit whatever position they have. Nepotism is a very big thing in Greece. I made the choice to get involved after. It doesn't mean that I didn't benefit from the name and I didn't benefit from his notoriety. I was elected in the municipal council in Athens. I want to say 50% because I was the son of my father, maybe even more. So I'm very aware of it. What I did with my election, that's another thing. I think that I did well, but that's not something to say. I think that working in this area and in this field where nothing existed after I was done with my term, something was left behind, and I think that this is important for me at least, and for people I work with. We are proud of the work that we did, but it was not a pathway that I had to take. it was not difficult to get out of it. Now I work in an NGO, so I'm not involved in politics directly. I still do politics, of course, and I know that if an opportunity occurs, I will take it, but in my own terms. And this is, I think, something important for me, doing the things that I want by having, you know, some type of context and putting my own terms and not giving up on the values. I mean, making as few concessions as possible and compromises. It's not easy, I know, but
indeed.
You know, I chose this, I had this choice and it works for the moment.
You kind of like swayed between family inspired, your own path, and how that kind of develops. In terms of your future, like where you see that going towards, will you go back to politics in terms of elected position? Are you working on that at the moment, or are you open to it? What does the future look like?
I'm thinking about it. I mean, we have elections, local elections in 10 days in Greece. I was asked to run with from mayors who are candidates. I had my own idea of having a common candidacy between the socialists and the left, in Athens at least. It didn't work out. I was considered to do, you know, for being this common candidate, etc. So I discussed about it a bit. I thought it was important to do it like this. I said that if we find another candidate who is a common candidate, I will also run with him, because it is important to have one candidacy between the two parties. The choice was to have two candidates. They both asked me to run with them. I said no, because I still believe that it was the best thing to do, to go against the current mayor and the current administration. So I stood my ground, I think. So I'm not a candidate. And this is the cost of saying no. You know, I'm not.
So that forging those links between the different parts of the left, and you said how in Greece, and I think across most Southern Europe and Middle East, politics is an integral part of society, but it never seems to translate away from a preset identity. What I mean by that is there is a lack of space within a family environment, within a tribal or cultural environment of context, to discuss these topics of politics, rather than always the discussion seems to sway around, this is what we believe, do you understand that? So kids, this is what we believe, there's no discussion about it, and that's how politics is run. And you find that kind of pathway is also in the leftist movement of, this is our values, you stick with it. And what that leads to is the lack of synergy and the lack of ability to cooperate with each other. How can we break that? Because that is one of the biggest achievements of the Paven de Aa and Groen Links in the Netherlands, is breaking that barrier and saying, but they broke the barrier, in my opinion, especially from the Paven de Aa side, from a position of weakness. We are so weak that it makes no sense to continue on this pathway. We tried everything on our own. It's not working. Now we need to try something else. That's good that it's happened, but the position of starting is not great. And I hear something similar in the story you're saying, is like, look, have we reached the bottom yet so that we can actually realize we need to cooperate together? Tell me more about how can we forge those links?
Look, first of all, in order to forge links, you have to be able to communicate with each other, not denying the dialogue or the access to the dialogue. Because in Greece, things are very heated when it comes to politics. There are some approaches that go like this. I mean, you say you are either with us or with the other. There is no middle ground. So, and if you, you know, years ago, many, many years ago, decades ago, it was even an insult to talk to others. And the family and the political family and the tribe felt betrayed if you talk to the other side. It's a very tribal thing. We operate within the household. And we have a saying in Greece, what happens in the house stays in the house. And we do not communicate good or bad things that happen in the house, because we don't want to be talked about. So it's a very, I would say Greek, but I think it, happening in other places, but it's a very tribal thing. So communicating with each other, even if we disagree on any point, of course, there are limits with whom we communicate, of course. Huh? I mean, we don't talk to Nazis, we don't talk to racists. I mean, you have limits. You put red line on that. And the problem is that the left broke this line. And the socialists before them, but the left did a leap of faith by partnering up with the far right, homophobic, racist, conspiracy theorists.
This was the Syriza
with
Syriza
independent
government.
Greeks. I mean, this broke the mold. I mean, it broke all limits. There was nothing after that.
They gave them the Ministry of Defense, I think, at the time in the government.
And others, and smaller ministries, but the main thing was the Ministry of Defense. And this is symbolic. They let them play with planes and boats and talking the nationalist, using the nationalist narrative, the national defense against Turkey, etc. So the whole symbolic nationalistic approach, you gave it to them. So there is no limit going down. I mean, we struck bottom after that. I mean, and then suddenly you are invoking the values, etc. What values? So there is this issue. This womb that's still open. So we need to change that, first of all. We need to heal in a way, but we also have to be able to communicate. Well, I'm one of these people that participates in many initiatives, political initiatives or, activistic initiatives. And I know my role because I'm one of the few people that can talk to anyone, as they say. I have friends who say, come on board because you can talk to everyone. You can convince others to come in. Because we are very... delimited, but you can do it. You can break the silence. So I understand my role. It's an interesting role, but it has limits because when both sides stick to their red lines, it's impossible to talk. So even if you want to play this intermediate role and bring sides closer together, which is not easy because in the end you get heckled by both sides and you're left on your own in a way, and you. Whenever you choose, the other side comes against you because why you chose them and not us? So it's always a very delicate placement, if you want, a very delicate position. But I think it's important to have these links and break these limits in order to open up the dialogue and talk about things. I mean, we are losing. Clearly, we are losing. And I think that the next European election, for example, it's going to be the gravestone of whatever effort. It's the last chance that we have. I mean, the simplest thing is to talk to all sides interested and as an interested party. I mean, as an interested party and as a party, a political movement or a political system, coming or at least talking to all sides saying, look, guys, we have issues. This is the last time. We need to change this. It doesn't work. I've talked about it, for example, to the European Greens about it, to change their approach in Greece and completely change the narrative and how they're willing to revive the Green Movement or to make it work. It doesn't work. They've been doing it for 10 years. It doesn't work. They need to change it. Does it mean that they need to change the people who are involved? Maybe. Does it mean that you need to change the people you support and you bring out as representatives of the Green Movement? Yes, for sure. The policies, of course. Do you have leverage? I think that the European Green Movement, yes. Still, I don't know after the European elections if they will have the same power. It is a question.
Yeah, because you see in Germany, for example, it's waning. Like the support for the Green Movement is waning. I mean, in the Netherlands, we have Frans Timmermans. He is basically the godfather of that, of the new Green Deal. It's so easy to target him and the whole green and socialist movement with facing them against what we see the rise of agricultural parties with agricultural policies, parties with anti-reduction of emissions. And that's across Europe, which is basically center-right or far-right grounds.
But the same
and you see that in Greece?
So now you see it in Greece, but you also see it in the context of migration. The weaponization of policies started in a I would say at an industrial level with migration 2015. And yes, we can be concerned about Greece, but look at what's happening in Hungary, in Poland, in the Czech Republic, in Slovenia, in the Baltic countries.
Is internationalism or socialist or leftist internationalism dead or dying?
Look, if we don't find another narrative and we cannot defend it in a different way, yes, I think it does. I mean, no one is convinced that it's a good thing to be able to live together or to be able to exchange views and to travel and to integrate unless we are white. And I'm exaggerating now. I know that it's a bit of an extreme argument. But, you know, behind all of it, if you look deeper, that's the main point. Let's do it between us. We don't need others to do it. So let's create a closed system where we can enjoy the benefits of our wealth and our development capacities. And let's take advantage of what we can and then fight the United States or China or whoever. But let's stay together and not allow anyone else to get in because they take resources from us while we need them. And we are not getting, you know, and we are losing citizens because we are getting older, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a, if you look at the data and you present an alternative theory based on data, and you try to explain what will come if we continue like this, I think that we can revert the tide. But we have to be very convincing, and we have to have a complete set of policies and proposals, and we need to do difficult choices. I mean, in the context of migration, we know that we will have to give ground. Yes, we do advocacy. Yes, I'm representing an NGO, and then I defend human rights. But look, we never said, publicly at least, that the international protection system for refugees has returns in it. When we defend the international protection system and international humanitarian law, returns are in the system, are embedded in the system. So we avoid the discussion because we are not pro-returns. Of course we are not. We need to give all people the opportunity to thrive. So it degrades the reality, the protection of refugees in the EU, and it's based on the policy that was implemented in the border of Greece and Turkey. And we use the example of 2015 as a crisis, but we forget that in 2022, we received 8 million Ukrainians in 8 months. And it was not considered to be a crisis. Why? Because they're white. Sorry, but this is the difficult discussion that we need to make. Simple answer to complicated questions. They don't understand why people move. Why do they come here? Why don't they go to countries that have the same religion as them? Why don't they stay over there, et cetera, et cetera? When you explain to them, for example, that 85% of people who move stay close to their countries, and what we see is the result of the other 10 to 15%, which is a smaller percentage of people on the move, basically. And what Europe sees is even less than that. So we know that, you know, national decisions and national conflicts or national political choices somewhere very far affect human mobility. We know that. People don't understand that. You cannot explain that to them. For example, can we explain now that thousands of Armenians are leaving Nagorno-Karabakh and they're going into Armenia? If someone ends up in the European border asking for asylum because he was living in Nagorno-Karabakh and ethnic, and they call it ethnic cleansing, etc., etc. Actually, it was not Armenia, but it was an enclave. So it's very complicated for people. They see something that happens over there, and the result is people on the border. That's it. And they need a simple answer. So we would need to present this simpler answer in a much different context. Yes, keeping up our values and our approaches, but we need to make it simpler. It's a very complicated world. People don't get it. They don't follow as quickly as they should or as they could or as they would. I don't know how to say that. But we need to make it simpler. And this means compromising because you see it all around Europe and you see it in the world. I mean, take the example of the US. People have a tendency to be conservative because the basic human instincts are conservative. Survival, it's the most conservative instinct. I need to survive. What will I do about it? Whatever it takes. This is the basis of conservatism. I need to survive. Then my family, then my extended family, then my tribe, then my clan, then my village, then my country, nationally. I put it very, very simply in a very bland way, but instincts are very conservative. So people have a tendency when they are pulled from two sides, the majority, the big majority, to go with a conservative choice. We see that. And as long as we pull the string to the two extremes, more and more people will become conservatives. And the more we do that, more progressive parts of political parties will become more conservative in order to keep, you know, the role more important, or keeping the role at least at the minimum.
Yeah, I'm really concerned that basic ideas of welfare support, basic ideas of worker rights, basic ideas of social housing, all these things that post World War II European states had as a default, because they were desperately needed to reassure people, have become radical ideas today.
Yeah.
If you propose a government to go spend $3 billion on housing in the Netherlands or any other European region, it'll be seen as, oh, you're intervening in the market. This is not the way forwards. It won't be of a good quality. Yada. It's the objection is from the left. The objection is from people who share your values, yet alone those on the right, yet alone from those who think in a market driven. So it's almost like, I totally agree with you. If I come advocate for internationalism today, it's radical. It's unprecedented. It's unacceptable almost from any party that's on the mainstream. And yet, if we don't, the consequences are we will continue to lose ground to people's instincts or people's instincts to try and keep things the way they are. I think the biggest disease of electoral politics today is the desire for stability.
Yep.
Everyone is desperate for stability. And that's probably why I think Syriza just voted for a new leader who just radiates a radical stability, I think, is the best way I could describe it.
Look, if you want my opinion, I will give it anyway. I mean, the election of this guy proved at least one thing. We hate women in Greece. We hate women. And it's the second time that the woman who is the favorite loses. It happened to the right also one time. The sister of the current prime minister lost the election for the presidency of the party. Basically, we hate women. We cannot imagine having women involved at such a high level of governance. So it's not something conscious, and people will disagree with me, I know. But unconsciously, we hate women. We are last at the index of genders in Greece. We try still to convince that equality is necessary and it costs money, inequality between genders, etc. So basic thing. And not only that, the guy and the way he speaks and the way he acts, it's a Trump model. He's from the States and he's very much affected by it. People do not agree. They disagree fervently with that. But we see it. You have words that come out, gestures, and the whole image. I mean, he appeared in the Congress when Syriza decided on who is going to be a candidate. He appeared with a blue navy suit and a red tie. You know what this is?
Syriza is historically more left than PASOK.
Yes.
Some say even communist, like as in old school communist.
Neo-communist.
Yep.
Or European
neo-communist. Yep.
That's not the problem with the tie. The blue navy suit with the red tie is the Trump outfit.
Hmm.
And I'm sure that at some level, the guy who proposed, or the team who proposed
team,
to him to do it, because there is a big discussion in the United States, now that Trump is not appearing in public because he has this legal stuff going on, etc., all his co-candidates, men, wear blue navy suits with red tie. And it's called the Trump outfit and the Trump meta effect. And there's a big discussion why they do that, even unconsciously. They want to create, they want to project that they're going to take place to the public. And he did that. And I'm sure that it is connected. But this is my...
You know what it is on one side, there are some identity politics involved in this gentleman's position. So it's on one side, it's very radical, who he is, his background, coming from the States, you know. And on the other side, it's like this typical white savior type approach. It's this paradox of what... the divisiveness of it. It's not driven by values, but it's driven by aesthetics. And I find that really
problematic. On top of that, people say, look, the most important thing in this context is that he brought his husband with him and he broke the mold that, you know, Greek society is hostile to gays, etc., etc. So this is important, the visibility. And I completely disagree. It's a very complex discussion in Greece because we are not there yet. How do you explain that even within the gay community, you have privileged people who are white. And if you see what white gay people vote in the States or in France, they're very, very conservative, extremely conservative in the context of identity. Yeah. They're white and they want to be white forever. So it's not because you're gay, that doesn't mean anything politically. It changes the view, it changes the visibility. But the value side and the political side, maybe it's worse. So we all mix it up, and then we have a mush. We have a cocktail of nothingness. But that's my opinion.
If Greek women tomorrow decided, as a collective, let's just say, to not go to work, Greece's economy would have to default on that day.
It has to do with society. It's a complex issue. And we are coming from a very long way. We come from a very traditional society, very paternalistic, very patriarchal, etc., etc. So it's a complex issue, actually very simple. But the past is there to lead the future, unfortunately, and we have to change it. And it won't change the way we do it. It has to be radical. And unfortunately, the political parties are falling into traps in order to make the discussion around gender equality. And it's wrong, completely wrong. And it costs to Greek society and the Greek economy, if you want.
Just on a last point, what advice do you give to activists who are trying to navigate the European political landscape today of identity politics, of discrimination, of promotion of the right and the threat of the far right? How can we maintain hope? What is your advice?
I can share my experience. Being an activist means that you are able to talk to anyone with the limits that I presented, at least, and everyone has its own limit, but let's say that it has to be broad, you know, a broad scope in order to be able to feel and understand the context, but in the same time, keep the values and not necessarily follow always the protocol. Being civil and polite, yes, but name what has to be named, even if this makes people uncomfortable. It's very simple advice because I see it around me when, for example, I discuss about racism and I say, look, guys, sorry, but this is racism and we need to call it out as it is. People usually feel uncomfortable. It's not a word that everyone likes. They feel that it generalizes things or it puts someone at an uncomfortable position. Yes, it doesn't matter because the things that are happening around us put us in a very difficult situation. And I'm sorry, but not to speak out against it just because it is uncomfortable, it's not enough. That's a very, I would say, simple advice because I especially this year, I decided that this way of doing exchanges with friends, colleagues, acquaintances, etc., being nice or polite at a very high level is not enough. We have to call things out as they are. Even if it makes people uncomfortable, you know, we need to keep the discussion at the level that it should be. And when it is racism, we have to call it out as racism. It's not going to change a lot of things, but at least you have a baseline. You say, look, we have to discuss above this. It's racism, that's it. Okay, you need to have arguments, you need to present your case. I'm not saying that's as simple as that. But, you know, being able to talk to a lot of people and keep things real, it is important.
I really appreciate that. It's about saying it type mentality. If we see something that is contradicts our values, we need to say something about it. And then at the same time, without contradicting it, open dialogue and discussion. I mean, democracy is built on that.
You can say, I understand your disagreement. I understand your point of view. I see where you're going with it or where you come from, etc. Yes, all of it. It's not a clear-cut case. It's not you're with us or against us. But you need to build your case. You need to explain why you see it like this. You need to give examples of history, how history evolved while we were waiting for things to change. I mean, we have the example of the First and the Second World War and what happened after it. And because of we talked a lot about Europe. Europe exists, the Union exists, because two countries that killed each other, literally killed each other for years, decided to cooperate and bring in all the others who also killed each other. The solution is not to kill each other again, is to keep it functioning based on values, remembering why we are here and why this started. It started because our grandparents killed each other. And if you look at national history, you will see even more examples. All families in Greece, for example, face the consequences of the civil war that followed the Second World War. So it's a womb. It's still an open womb. And I believe that in many countries, we see that people who collaborated with the Nazis or countries that collaborated with the Nazis, Germany itself. So we have historical wounds and we cannot forget about them. Not keeping them alive, but not forgetting about them is important. History is important, and having a knowledge, basic knowledge of why we are here today and we are able to discuss amongst us.
Lovely, man. Really appreciate your time. And I know you've had a very busy day. I know that today you had some troubles in your office. I really hope they are resolved.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're right there behind you. I hope that we will see I was just about to say new dawn, but that means something very different in Greek, in Greece. I hope we have a new sunrise of cooperation and forging links in Greece for a better Europe and a better world.